And we are back to the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Monday, April 22nd. For the Virginia Voice, your readers are Pete Legato and Tracy Lynch.
I'm Pete Legato, and we're looking now at the opinions page. We have two columns on the opinions page, both under the giant headline, Border Blueprint. The first of these is by Benjamin Powell, a senior fellow at the Independent Institute and a professor of economics at Texas Tech University. He is co-author of Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions. He wrote this column for InsideSources.com, and it's been headlined, Hike Legal Immigration to Stem Migrant Surge. Given Donald Trump's rhetoric during the Republican primaries, immigration enforcement at our southern border is likely to be a major focus of his presidential campaign. But any solution to our border difficulties must entail reforms that make legal immigration more plausible for would-be migrants. Trump said in a Super Tuesday speech last month that things are happening that are unthinkable at the border. There are millions of people invading our country. This is an invasion. Though his rhetoric is extreme, undocumented immigrants had a record 2.5 million encounters with border agents in 2023, causing difficulties for many communities. Increased enforcement alone will not solve our problems. Migrants have massive economic opportunities in the United States. So the root cause of undocumented immigration is U.S. policy that essentially prohibits legal migration for most people. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, Mexicans accounted for more than 30% of the people apprehended or denied entry at the border over the last 4 years. Hondurans, 9.2%, Guatemalans, 9%, Venezuelans, 5.8%, and Cubans, 5.8%, rounded out the top five nationalities attempting to enter the United States illegally. The economic gains for low-skilled migrants from those countries are massive. Economists Michael Clements, Claudio Montenegro, and Lant Pritchett estimate that a 35-year-old Mexican male with less than a high school education earns about 2.5 times more in the United States than in Mexico. Guatemalans earn close to 3 times more, and Venezuelans 6.5 times more than in their home countries. Though data are unavailable for Hondurans and Cubans, the magnitudes are likely similar. No plausible legal path to the United States exists for most people from those countries, unless they are a spouse, child, or parent of a U.S. citizen. Family connections account for nearly 80% of all legal immigration to the United States, but visa applications for anyone from those countries with family connections, beyond spouses, children, and parents, are backlogged. For example, 1.2 million Mexican siblings of U.S. citizens are waiting for permission to migrate. Still, only 5,600 of these visas are issued annually. At that rate, it would take 224 years to clear the backlog. Unskilled workers in those countries rarely qualify for employment-based visas that require special skills, a particular labor shortage, or large sums of investment capital. Mexicans, Guatemalans, and Hondurans are ineligible for the diversity visa lottery. Though Cubans and Venezuelans are eligible, the chance of winning is only 0.1 to 0.2%. That leaves asylum or refugee status as the only plausible path to legal immigration for most people. Only 28,000 refugee visas were approved annually in the decade leading up to the pandemic. Furthermore, to receive this status, immigrants must prove to the U.S. government that they have been or will be persecuted in their country of origin. So, the U.S. prohibits legal immigration for most people who try to enter the United States illegally to secure economic gains. Increased enforcement may decrease the number of illegal migrants, but it will also lead to ever-escalating conflict as would-be migrants and their smugglers redouble their efforts to evade enforcement. Any long-term solution to the crisis at the southern border must include more paths for legal migration for low-skilled workers in Latin American countries. These would-be immigrants can't come to America legally unless we give them a legal line to get in, so they have a plausible chance of getting to the front. That opinion was Hike Legal Immigration to Stem Migrant Surge by Benjamin Powell.
Thank you, Peter. Second opinion piece is written by Stephen Camerata. Camerata is the Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. He wrote this piece for InsideSources.com. Its title, Enforce the Law So Fewer People Get In. We often hear from politicians that they are, quote, against illegal immigration, but in favor of legal immigration. Though this refrain may sound safely moderate, it actually ducks the critical policy questions related to immigration. Who may come, how many, and how do we enforce the limits we set? Even as a record level of immigration is creating huge challenges for housing, schools, workplaces, and hospitals, few people are answering these questions. In February, the total foreign-born immigrant population, including legal and illegal immigrants, hit a high of 51.4 million in the government's monthly household survey, up 6.4 million since President Joe Biden took office, according to the Center for Immigration Studies. At 15.5% of the U.S. population, the foreign-born share rivals that of the so-called great wave of immigration of the 1890s. Illegal immigration is a long-standing problem, but research by the Migration Policy Institute shows the number of undocumented immigrants was relatively stable in the years before the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, all of that has changed. The border crisis was partly caused by the president's campaign promises to curtail immigration enforcement. Ending the, quote, remain in Mexico policy for asylum applicants, terminating Title 42 too soon, which returned border crossers to Mexico, and suspending the asylum cooperative agreements with Central American countries all spurred illegal immigration. The administration also decided to curtail the use of detention and, quote, expedited removal, which sends undocumented immigrants back to their home countries quickly. All of this caused border encounters to skyrocket. So far, the United States has released 3.3 million undocumented immigrants into the country, according to Congress, and 1.7 million have been seen crossing illegally but evaded U.S. Border Patrol. Many foreign-born people in the United States are legal immigrants. Our legal immigration system is mainly based on familial relationships, not skills. This is why many new immigrants have no education beyond high school. Less educated immigrants earn low wages and make modest tax contributions, even when paid on the books. Their use of welfare programs, which they often qualify for through their U.S.-born children, creates significant costs for taxpayers. By artificially increasing the supply of workers, legal and illegal immigration depress wages for the poorest and least educated Americans. Additionally, our reliance on immigrant labor has allowed society to ignore the huge increase in less educated men not in the labor force, neither working nor looking for work. They do not show up as unemployed because they are not actively looking for work. The rise in non-work is linked to serious social pathologies, including crime and overdose deaths. We need to undo the administration's border policies, increase deportations, and penalize employers who hire undocumented immigrants. stopping localities from releasing jailed immigrants and denying them welfare, driver's licenses, and in-state college tuition would also help. Considering all the things we do to encourage illegal immigration, it's absurd to suggest, as some do, that we have seriously tried to enforce the law. We can move to a legal immigration system that reduces the numbers and selects immigrants based on their skills. We can also enforce our laws. Immigration is not the weather. It can be controlled and managed to benefit the American people. Again, this piece entitled Enforce the Law So Fewer People Get In was written by Stephen Camerata.
And that's our opinion page for today. We'll have no letters to the editor. So we'll move back to some local news on the front page. Stakes high for motorcyclists. Fatalities climb in warmer months. This is by Samuel B. Parker of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. The accident happened so quickly that he barely remembers it. Dana Kitchen, who grew up in Richmond and now lives on Smith Mountain Lake, was riding his motorcycle down Charter Colony Parkway in Chesterfield County on the evening of March 14, 2019, when a bus traveling in front of him drifted into the left lane, causing the driver of a car next to the bus to panic and slam on the brakes. The next thing Kitchen knew, he was on the ground, in terrible pain, he said. He had braked suddenly in an attempt to avoid a collision with the car, he said. His bike had skidded out from under him and thrown his body into the pavement. The impact shattered his left leg below the knee, cracked his pelvis, dislocated his ankle, and badly bruised his shoulder. I had reacted, and boom, it was over, Kitchen said. It would be weeks before Kitchen could walk again, let alone dress himself, drive, or use the bathroom unassisted, he said. He would undergo three major reconstructive surgeries, develop and fight a morphine addiction in the process, and in his darkest moments, wish he had died that evening. Today, despite the horrific circumstances, Kitchen considers himself fortunate to be here, and in many ways he is. In the 15 years between 2008 and 2022, 1,398 people died as a result of crashes involving motorcycles in Virginia, nearly 100 people per year, according to data from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. Those fatalities surge in the spring and summer months as the weather warms and Virginians hit the open roads on their bikes. In 2022, the most recent year for which data is available, motorcycle crash-related fatalities across the state jumped in April and peaked in May and June before eventually declining in November. A total of 118 people died in motorcycle-related incidents in Virginia that year. Of those deaths, 67, or nearly 57%, occurred between April and August. And the numbers are headed in the wrong direction. Between 2008 and 2014, there were an average of roughly 85 motorcycle-related fatalities in Virginia per year. Since 2014, that figure has jumped to more than 100. Just this month, as temperatures crept into the 70s, there were three deadly motorcycle crashes in Henrico County in the span of only 2 days, between April 8th and 9th. One on West Broad Street, one on Libby Avenue, and one on Interstate 295. But for divine intervention, Kitchen told the Richmond Times-Dispatch that he would have been another such statistic. It's actually a miracle, he said of his survival. Kitchen got lucky that day in 2019, he said. At the time of the accident, he was on his way home from Bon Secours St. Francis Medical Center, where he worked as a radiology technician. As a result, the scene of the crash was only a few blocks from the hospital, and the first responders who picked him up were friends from work. Kitchen said the rescue squad just happened to be passing by in an ambulance when they came across him in the road. They said, "Dana, do you need a ride to the hospital?" Kitchen recalled. And I said, "I think I do." Kitchen was rushed to the emergency room, where he got lucky again. Initially, the ER director determined that Kitchen's case was too serious for St. Francis and planned to transfer him to another facility, Kitchen said. But another one of Kitchen's friends, trauma surgeon Jacob Budney, was in the hospital that night, and he knew that Kitchen would lose his leg if he did not immediately undergo surgery to reduce the swelling. Budney told them, "I can save his leg if we do it here and now," Kitchen said. He was so adamant that they gave in to him. Budney performed the emergency operation that spared Kitchen an amputation at the left knee, a fact for which Kitchen said he is forever grateful. But his path to recovery had only just begun. Kitchen's leg essentially had to be rebuilt. Surgeons worked to stabilize his tibia and then pieced the bone back together with plates and screws, Kitchen said. After multiple surgeries, he was exhausted, scared, and hooked on morphine. "I was a mess," Kitchen said. "I was extremely worried that I would never walk again, and I was depressed. There were a couple of times that I wished I had died." A factor in that depression was what Kitchen described as the complete humiliation of being utterly reliant on others and forced to relearn some of life's most basic tasks and functions. "I had to learn to do everything over again," Kitchen said. "It was quite the wake-up to be dependent on somebody else." Today, after months of therapy and by the grace of God, Kitchen said, he is able to walk without a limp. But the scars serve as reminders of how close he came to losing everything in a mere instant. "It has actually given me a new perspective on life and how fragile I actually am. I used to have this air of invisibility around me, or invincibility around me. And the accident made me realize it could all change in the blink of an eye." Stories like Kitchen's underscore just how high the stakes are for motorcyclists, said Elizabeth Sorrell of Smithville, an attorney for Tom McGrath's Motorcycle Law Group in Richmond. Sorrell represents the victims of motorcycle accidents, and in the course of her career has seen just how profoundly such an accident can change a person's life. "I've had amputees who can't wear prosthetics, so they become wheelchair-bound and need a special vehicle," she said. "I've had clients who have had to have their jaws wired, had their sinuses and vision permanently impacted, and had to undergo years of surgeries." In addition to the physical risks, Sorrell said motorcycle accidents can exact an extreme financial toll. The costs of medical treatment and physical therapy, coupled with potential job and income loss, have the potential to be ruinous. "It's very devastating," she said. Sorrell said the nature of her cases has changed over the years. While left turns across traffic in front of motorcycles accounted for roughly 90% of her cases a decade ago, her cases today are most likely to be a result of distracted driving, an issue Sorrell placed squarely on cell phones. "It's rear-enders. It's sideswipers due to cell phones distracting. That's a major part of it," she said. Sorrell said another common problem is that many drivers are subconsciously scanning traffic for larger vehicles and, as a result, often do not notice or process motorcycles. "Motorcyclists can blend into the background," she said, advising drivers to be more conscious of the fact that not every vehicle on the road is a four-wheel vehicle. "Look and then look again," she added. If you look for the motorcycle, you'll always see the car. So always look for the motorcycle. Kerry Abrams, who in 1993 founded the Richmond Riders Motorcycle Club, has been riding for nearly 52 years. And, like so many of her biker peers, once had her own brush with death. Abrams was stopped at the intersection of West Broad Street and Arthur Ashe Boulevard one evening when she was rear-ended by a vehicle going nearly 50 miles per hour, she said. I was sitting still at a traffic light, and the next thing I knew, I was flying in the air. I did a somersault, and I landed standing up on the concrete median. Somehow, she was completely unscathed. The experience was a reality check. It was a compelling reminder of the dangers that motorcyclists face on the road every day. But it also made her realize how much she loved riding. When you ride and you're dedicated to the sport, you have to realize that if you haven't gone down, you will, she said. And when you fall off a horse, the best thing to do is get back up on one. So there was never a thought of not getting back up on my bike. Like Sorrell, Abrams said drivers should look twice for motorcyclists. I've had people that were looking directly at me and I knew they were going to pull out in front of me, she said. People are used to seeing two headlights spaced apart. When a motorcycle is coming at you, it's hard to judge the distance of a single little line. At times, drivers will follow motorcyclists too closely or attempt to share the lane with them. Behavior, Abrams says, does not take into account how exposed and vulnerable motorcyclists are. Abrams also said motorcyclists face certain hazards that for other drivers are little more than a nuisance. Grass in the road is bad, Abrams said, and people who cut their lawn near a road should take measures to avoid spitting the clippings onto the pavement. Gravel, litter, and leaves can also be dangerous, she said, so people should avoid throwing objects onto the road and should be careful to secure any items that may be strapped to their vehicles. We're more prone to any imperfections in the road surface, Abrams said, and we're definitely more prone to anything on the surface that isn't supposed to be there. The responsibility lies with motorcyclists, too, Abrams said. She often sees motorcyclists speeding and driving recklessly down Hilliard Road near her home, and that sort of behavior gives motorcycling a bad name, she said. We have to deal with our own community, too, she said. It's some of these younger kids that get out there on motorcycles that have way too much horsepower, and they more than likely have not been through formal training, and they think they're indestructible. But there are certain steps every motorcyclist can take to make themselves safer on the road. For example, Abrams said motorcyclists should always wear helmets and other appropriate gear and use hand signals. And all motorcyclists, novices and veterans alike, should take courses from certified instructors to hone their skills. I don't care how good you think you are, she said. You can always be better. Kitchen agreed. Everybody should take a motorcycle safety course before they buy a bike, he said. While Kitchen has not ridden since the accident and does not plan to do so again, he said his experience has made him more conscious of motorcyclists than he was, even when he rode among them. Kitchen stressed one particular lesson that he learned firsthand. Motorcycles require more time and space to stop safely. And so, giving motorcyclists extra room to navigate is not just a matter of courtesy, but one of life and death. I have a newfound awareness on the road, he said. As temperatures rise and motorcyclists return to the open road in droves, Kitchen often hears them roar past his home. He wistfully described the joy of riding, the wind in his face, the views, the smells and the sounds of the world whizzing past him. "I miss it," he said. "I really do. But I can control my feelings. I have to physically say to myself, that's not for me. And every day when I wake up, I'm thankful that I'm still here, able to enjoy a nice sunrise," he added. "Some have not been so lucky, and others still choose to ride despite the risks. They are trusting that other drivers will treat them with respect and value their safety. In May, Abrams will take her motorcycle from Virginia to Key West, Florida. She's looking forward to the trip," she said, "despite the danger. I've just fallen in love with it," she said. "This is what I'm supposed to be doing." And that article by Samuel B. Parker was on the front page, "Stakes High for Motorcyclists." And now we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment with today's obituaries and more news. Stay with us, please.